When you find reality is yanked violently from straight ahead to the hard insane right, you know you're off the beaten path. Defenestrate Media and The Left Show present The Sidetrack with Jason Williams.
Welcome to The Sidetrack. I'm Jason Williams, and I have to be honest with everyone, I'm recording this minutes after having seen Midsommar, the sophomore effort by the writer-director of Hereditary. And having seen Hereditary, I should have known what I was getting into. Go see it, though. I really liked that. I'm not in the business of reviewing movies, but I really liked, let me put it this way, I enjoyed the experience of watching that movie as a horror movie fan. It's not your typical horror movie. There aren't a lot of scary pop-out scenes, and everything takes place in the daylight. But again, having seen Hereditary, I guess I should have known what I was getting into. Same writer and director. Go see it. It was an interesting experience, and I'm still kind of thinking about it a bit. So it's taking me a second as I record here to get into the groove of what I wanted to talk about this week, which is kind of a threefer, if you will, but all of them connected. This, starting out, was a poll, getting some discussion online today and yesterday, and it's worth the discussion. It was a credible poll done by the Washington Post and ABC, and the poll had a specific section on Medicare for All, or a public option if no private insurance was available or replacing private insurance. By the way, the troll also had candidate matchups, and it did show, strangely enough, for Democrats, it did show Biden still in the lead, which I'm still thinking that fades, but it's had some legs that I didn't expect. So maybe it doesn't fade. I don't know. Harris second, Warren in third place, and Sanders, man, he cannot get any traction this go around. I think most likely because he isn't saying anything different than he was the last go around, and so he's got his set follower group, and they're loud and vocal, but Sanders not doing a lot to attract new attention. And I think when you've got this many people on the figurative and literal stage with you during the primary contest, you gotta be wowing people somehow. Elizabeth Warren still wowing me the most, although Kamala Harris is a lot more impressive than I thought she would be as a candidate. I've always liked her as an elected official, but I thought she'd be kind of deadpan and a little boring even as a candidate. Not so. Biden, you've heard me talk about him. I actually think Biden is kind of hilarious. But the way he handled the Mr. Hansy thing was, I think, indicative of a mindset that makes him a bad candidate. But also he's the only person up there with a long, long, long history as a legislator, and he's going to have to defend it all, which is why I say again, I would have preferred he just stay the good friend of the first black president and leave it there. Let the memes be your legacy, Joe. But here he is. Anyway, this poll included a question. Again, Washington Post ABC poll included a question about Medicare for All. And short version, 43% in support, 49% opposed. Backing of universal health insurance in general in replacement of a private insurance option, as the poll worded the question. Democrats, 64% approve. Republicans, 14% only approve. And independents, about 40%. It's not a bad poll, and it's just one poll. And it got a lot of attention because, well, there's no other really credible polling going on right now specifically. But what I want to talk about actually is how the poll was responded to, how the poll was covered in the press. And basically, it was covered over the last several days from one angle. When it came to that specific question, I Googled quite a bit, actually, looking for news stories on this. And from national outlets, always see something a little bit better when it comes to local outlets. But this being a national poll done by the Washington Post, mostly covered by national outlets. And I couldn't find a single national outlet that wasn't reporting on this poll from the perspective of, well, basically see this plan that the left of the Democratic Party is pushing candidates to talk about and either endorse or not during this primary contest over the next year-ish, is really unpopular with the general public, with normal Americans, with Main Street America. Medicare for All is not popular. That's how it was reported every single time. The framing on the way any poll like this that deals with something as wedded to the left as Medicare for All is always talked about in those terms. And it's a really subtle bias. And I've talked about this before on previous episodes that sometimes I think the media is so afraid of the so aptly named by Hillary Clinton in the 90s right-wing noise machine. They're so afraid of that. They're so afraid of being accused of bias. They ironically become biased towards the left, towards Democrats in general, but mostly the left, trying to prove that they aren't biased. And it's gone on for so long now, and there are other things that influence this too. A lot of times the corporate ownership, I think, is a heavy thumb on that scale. And so there are a lot of reasons this happens, but it's consistent. And that's what's important to realize. But the way this issue is framed is like many other things, again, framed as see how unpopular Medicare for All is. All the Democrats are talking about it. It was even a little bit of a dust up around Harris and her campaign when she kind of endorsed doing away with private insurance during the debate and then came back later and said, oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. And so here you have every national outlet that did report on this poll saying, see how unpopular Medicare for All is. As one headline read, it was implying that just the idea of eliminating private health insurance is, quote, wildly unpopular. But as a juxtaposition, courtesy of my friend and a very smart writer, Asita Nuanovo, who, if you're not following or reading, you probably should be, for his it's really coming out of left field takes that end up being super insightful. So you have this poll, and then you have all the coverage that's focused on how, quote, wildly unpopular Medicare for All is, despite the fact that all of the Democratic candidates are talking about it. Normal America hates it. And this poll, like so many before it, proves that. The poll, again, does show a majority opposed, but not a huge majority opposed. Let's go back to the numbers again. Support, 43%. Oppose, 49%. It was among Democrats, 64% approval for some sort of public replacement to private insurance. Republicans, for only 14% in support of, and independents, 40%. Those actually aren't horrible numbers, but that's not the point I'm trying to make today. The point I'm trying to make is look at some of the polling on some of the issues Republicans are, for more than one election cycle, in the case of overturning Roe v. Wade, you're talking nearly 30 years plus of Republicans endorsing that, every Republican candidate ever, as either something they support in a party platform as a goal or something they themselves plan to try and do. It's always been just a cash cow freebie for them. So they talk about it. And yeah, I mean, if they really wanted to do something about this, there were legislative avenues at their disposal at the federal level this whole time. So after a while, it starts to seem that, well, they don't really want to go there, but it's great at scaring their base and getting their base to open their wallets. So they talk about it all the time. Now, of course, you have these examples from this year alone of some batshit insane state lawmakers in several states now, sadly, actually going there and saying, we realize this is unconstitutional, but we want it to go to the Supreme Court. We want to have this fight over Roe v. Wade. that's a conversation for another day. But contrasting the public polling on something like Roe v. Wade, for example, overturning Roe v. Wade, it's no comparison. It is much less popular than this poll and most polls that you'll see on Medicare for All or a generic public option to replace private insurance or the general idea of replacing private insurance with something public in the first place. All of those poll much higher by 10, sometimes 20 points when it comes to approval, disapproval breakdown in these polls. Consistently, overturning Roe v. Wade is far less popular than what this Washington Post ABC poll and what any poll you will find on the two would show you. And yet, when Republicans are talked about by national media outlets, the language is different. So here you have a poll again showing that there is a majority opposed to Medicare for All, but not a huge majority. And it's talked about from the context of, look at the Democrats in their primary, all talking about and endorsing something that is, quote, wildly unpopular with the public. But when Republican candidates or when this president does himself talk about it, which he will, overturning Roe v. Wade, the language is different. The media shifts at that point and starts talking about, well, yeah, it's just Republicans speaking to their base. So Democrats are endorsing, quote, wildly unpopular ideas. Republicans are just innocently charging up their base. It's politics, right? If Trump stakes out some horrendously unpopular ground on a certain issue, he also is just exciting his base. He's just getting the rallies energetic. He's just making sure that those for sure voters stay for sure voters so they can focus on the less for sure voters. Democrats, again, though, are endorsing a, quote, wildly unpopular idea. Dave Weigel tweeted in response to the same conversation started by Nuanavu. And he pointed out something I thought was worth including here. He said campaigns usually minimize unpopular positions. Trump is far weaker than he should be because he has so many extremely unpopular takes, meaning basically, you know, he's the incumbent. If Trump wasn't nuts and stupid and racist, he could actually be a fairly popular president, despite the fact that his ideas and the Republican Party's core ideas, like overturning Roe v. Wade, are themselves wildly unpopular. So Weigel is pointing out that it's the bad takes Trump can't stay away from that he's known for now at this point that hold him back. And Weigel points out that the wall, for example, the wall is across the board unpopular. Across the board, there has not been a good poll, period, credible poll, done. There is not a single poll that will show you a majority of Americans in support of building a border wall. But now go out and try and find that being talked about or even mentioned in most news stories. Again, for Republicans, they're just firing up their base, and Democrats are the ones that need to explain why they're all getting behind this, quote, extremely, wildly, horrendously unpopular idea. It's just something to watch for a little bit and call out any chance you get. This kind of stuff matters, though, because the language, the linguistics of even a headline can have an impact. So what people are hearing is, so they're constantly hearing, wildly unpopular or public opposite, majority opposition. They're hearing terms like that whenever a Democratic candidate or a policy idea coming from the left is being discussed. And then when something like overturning Roe v. Wade, which has very little public support, even in conservative states, or building a border wall, which has very little public support, then you'll hear language that is a little more excusing, a little more innocent, I think. And we have an overall problem with this in the media at large. I bitch about Bret Stephens here often, and I'm going to again before the end of this episode. But there is a consistency to this, from the op-ed pages to subtle editorial decisions like headlines to the way polls are covered. And one more time, it's Democrats are going out on a limb, really taking a risk, endorsing a wildly unpopular policy position. Republicans doing the exact same on paper. When you look at the polls and do the math, Republicans, though, are just firing up their base. Sure, overturning Roe v. Wade has no majority support anywhere in the country. But it's just Republicans for 35, 40 years just firing up their base. It's innocent. Democrats, though. So something to watch for. Tying this all together again with how language and how we talk about things. The last thing I want to ever be known for is someone that's running around screaming media bias. Because the only consistent bias you should really be concerned about is more of a corporate bias. And it's more of a what gets reported bias. And it's a business model bias. And that is a serious problem when it comes to American media. It used to be a national media problem. Now it's a local media problem, too. And that's unfortunate. As far as partisan bias, I don't think we've ever seen consistent enough of a trend with any broad swath of credible media to justify any accusation of a consistent partisan bias. Obviously, you've got leans and you've got reporters who may have their own personal partisan opinions. But the real bias, again, is in the business model and the corporate ownership and the advertising-driven decisions and the editorial decisions that are made. And then, of course, there's the decision of who to put on your op-ed page, which there's some few problems there. Before we get to that, though, this ties in. This was research done at Stanford that, while I was thinking about this very thing, kind of mulling this over, what would you actually do to combat this? How would you even take on the actual bias that exists in media? How would you convince journalists and editors at, say, the New York Times that they no longer have to keep bending over backwards every time some MAGA moron is upset about something? Because if they don't cover it, they'll be accused of bias. How would you challenge that mentality, that sort of Stockholm syndrome that exists, especially at the New York Times? How would you challenge the victimhood that the Republican Party itself has actually turned into an art form when it comes to how mistreated they are by the news and everything, because the stories don't make them look good because they don't look good. Well, I mean, on that one, I don't think you can challenge that one outside of just pointing a finger and laughing and letting that burn out and become, I'll put it this way, that's not going to go away until it stops being useful for the Republican Party to do so. And that's going to happen before you'll run out of useful idiots willing to reinforce that mentality. State lawmaker in my own state do that just today, claiming that all of this viral Instagram post of someone getting upset that the new live action Little Mermaid from Disney is going to have a black Ariel and intentionally missing the point. This Republican state lawmaker said, well, I don't really know anybody upset about this. Well, I'm sorry. It went viral. And also, I guarantee if you went out and talked to the delegates in your party in this state, we'd all be shocked. Because I've talked to them, and I know you have, man. Anyway, yeah, sure, there's no racism in the Republican Party. I guess. It's all just a picture painted by the liberal media. But the point I'm trying to make here is there are these tropes, and that's maybe not a good word. There are these almost like tenets of a religion within both parties, admittedly. But when it comes to the Republican Party versus the Democratic Party on these types of almost dogmatic beliefs and often repeated phrases and even thinking that you'll see within both parties is very different. And some research just published by Stanford University touches on this a little bit. They focused on it. It's actually amazing they were able to do this in the first place. But they looked at 4.4 million tweets. They had to pick a platform, basically. And yeah, you can have that conversation, too, about different results from different platforms, and I'm sure you'd see it. But they had to pick a platform. Twitter was the easiest to collect data from, so they went with Twitter. And they looked at 4.4 million tweets posted in response to 21 different mass shootings from 2015 to 2018. So that included, say, the Orlando nightclub shooting. And so in that 3-year period, they looked at 4.4 million tweets that were posted by anybody in direct response to a mass shooting. There were 21 different mass shooting events in this time frame. And so anyone that was directly commenting or responding to a news story or linking to a news story themselves in an original tweet, anything like that, they were able to scour Twitter's data, the archives from this 2015 to 18 period, and they took a look at everything. And they found, some pretty interesting results. They found that Republicans are more likely to express fear and disgust in response to a mass shooting, whereas Democrats were more likely to attempt to communicate sadness and calls for action. So Republicans would express fear and disgust at the event. Democrats would express their sadness that the event happened and then be more likely to say, we need to do something about this. Republicans were 25% more likely than Democrats to write the word terrorist in a tweet in response to a mass shooting if the shooter was African-American, Hispanic, Middle Eastern, not white, basically. Democrats were 25% more likely to use the word terrorist if the shooter was white. Illuminating some of the partisan politics that frame the discussion around this. Researchers said in the published results, they wrote in the executive summary that they were trying to answer three main questions. What is different about how Democrats and Republicans talk on Twitter? If there is something different about how they talk, what is it? Could Republicans and Democrats be identified based on particular word usage in tweets alone? And how can the differences help understand the causes and consequences of social media polarization? So some of the interesting things they found, they developed a method. This was developed by Stanford economist Matthew Gentzko. And you can read about, he wrote quite a bit about the method he developed for putting this research together. And he worked with Brown University economist Jesse Shapiro. And they're actually co-authors of this study alongside economist Matt Taddy. And they'd done previous research looking at language in speeches on the House floor and the Senate floor, also worth a read if you have the time. But they took this method that they developed and they applied it to the language of this 4.4 million tweet database. Again, all tweets in response to or in some way discussing, talking about, linking to a news story about one of the 21 mass shootings that occurred between 2015 and 18. And they excluded retweets, by the way. If someone was just retweeting someone else, they didn't look at that. And then they they tried to, through their analysis, predict. After they looked at a lot of the language that was being used repeatedly in various tweets, they built this little mini model, and then they tried to predict whether or not a tweet was from a Republican or a Democrat. And they focused on responses to mass shootings, they said, because they're events that got a lot of attention, so there'd be a lot more tweeting, basically, easier to get a data set. And that there were also events with very clear objective facts. That was something else they wanted to look to. If there was a partisan difference to either highlighting or retaining or reinforcing the objective facts being reported or blurring them to see if people twisted things a little bit. So they found that when people mentioned an earlier shooting in context of, or if someone mentioned the number of mass shootings recently in context to the specific shooting that happened that day, they were 2.7 times more likely to be a Democrat than a Republican. Republicans tended, in fact, not to mention previous school shootings at all, or at least not often. Democrats did, and they were most inclined to mention the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting if they did reference. So Democrats more likely to reference a previous shooting or to make reference to the number of previous shootings in response to the shooting that happened that day. And they were, when they did, they were more likely to mention it. And then when they did mention it, they were more likely to mention Sandy Hook than any other. Republicans, on the other hand, were 2.5 times more likely to mention any event of mass violence that involved a person of color, including bringing up September 11th, 2001 a lot. And so researchers said that what they saw was a degree of polarization in the tweets that also that was right there from the beginning, but also began to increase as the hours and then days went on. In fact, what they found is that there's a zenith. There's an event horizon point, if you will, on polarization with tweets. And it's roughly between 3 and 4 days out from the original event. So if there's a mass shooting 3 and 4 days later, that's when you'll see the polarization on Twitter, at least. It reach its pinnacle, its zenith, and then start to ebb a bit. And people stop being as polarized as they discuss the event. The research basically confirms previous research that shows there is a definite relationship between people's political beliefs and their personalities, at least as far as how they convey their personalities, how they choose to express themselves. And it also reveals that there are different emotions that are at least expressed. I mean, obviously, this research can't tell you what emotions a person tweeting was feeling, but there are very different emotions that were expressed by people of different political makeup, political leanings or partisanship on Twitter in response to a tragedy like a mass shooting. So they did notice some other things. They said there was an obvious difference in speech patterns between Republicans and Democrats. And then the study also found that there was this polarization of language on social media in general that researchers and scientists have known about for a long time was even more evident when they looked at tweets by people responding to a mass shooting. And now they were clear to say that, you know, further research is needed before any concrete linguistic differences can be laid out as an objective fact here. But this research does point out some trends, basically. And these trends have remained consistent now in 3 or 4 pretty robust research efforts at various universities just here in the United States. There's even more overseas happening. So one of the authors said that in the executive summary that ideological polarization happens very fast after an event like a mass shooting and then hangs out and again increases actually for 3 to 4 days before starting to ebb. And that as soon as an event, the author wrote, like a mass shooting happens, people react very differently. That's understandable and expected. What wasn't expected is how predictable identifying a person's side of the political aisle, if you will, was. how easy it was for research to look at certain words used. For example, in the study, they found that Democrats were far more likely than Republicans to use phrases like need to, should, have to, must, before a specific call for political action, which, again, Republicans weren't using at all. Democrats, to summarize the summary, also had that tendency by a three to one margin. Democrats had more of a tendency to contextualize mass shootings by bringing up the frequency, by bringing up the number of mass shootings that had happened just that year or in previous years, by bringing up a specific mass shooting. Most frequently, we mentioned Sandy Hook elementary school shooting. Republicans, not likely to do that at all, tended to focus on the specific mass shooting and express disgust that it had happened, linked to a news story, and leave it at that. No call to action, no context, almost as if for that person, that mass shooting was the first one to ever happen ever and will be the last one, and so requires no action other than recognition of the tragedy that specific day. And man, does that not reveal where the current Republican Party is at. And at that point, you're left with a chicken or the egg question. Are the Republicans within the party responsible for this? Or is the party responsible for this? And registered Republicans throughout the nation have just fallen in line. We'll try to answer that question on another day, but check out the research. It's pretty easy to find. Again, it was published by Stanford University. It's very revealing and says a lot about what you'll see from both parties right now. And again, paints a picture of a deep connection between what you're hearing and seeing from party leadership and what you're hearing and seeing from the rank and file in both parties. And again, chicken or the egg, who is that? Is that being pushed downward from leadership? Or is that coming up to leadership because that's where registered Republicans and Democrats really are? I don't know. I have my theories, though. Anyway, speaking of language and the way people use it, New York Times resident moron Brett Stevens wrote another article, and it it contains some language. So remembering where we started here today, before talking about how people, words people choose and whether or not they contextualize a mass shooting and how that can predict what political party they belong to, we start out here with what happens in the media, and the media having this tendency to overcompensate for criticisms of liberal bias and create, ironically, an actual conservative bias in usually in what they choose to cover, but also, as I mentioned, the language of how they talk about it. So back to language here, and it really does matter what people say and how they say it and the words they use. And so the language, again, with pulling on Medicare, showing that Democrats were always talked about from a, oh, look at how they're endorsing this, quote, wildly unpopular idea. And then when Republicans talk about something like overturning Roe v. Wade, which is actually wildly unpopular, they're talked about with words like energizing their base, red meat to the rank and file. And so it's almost excused by the media. And you'll find that trend hold up. Another example of the same type of bias is in, I mentioned editorial decisions, but there's also the same type of bias in hiring decisions. And that brings us to New York Times resident moron Brett Stevens. How did this guy get a job? Even if you don't have an answer to that question, how does this guy keep his job? In one of his most recent columns, Stevens, getting some heat for this one, and we'll talk about his response to it. What he said, basically, he's writing about the same type of thing here. He's claiming to be this. So if you don't know Stevens, I don't blame you. And I can't say it's worth getting to know his back catalog. But short version, this is a guy who claims to be a never Trump sort of moderate Republican, although I don't think he's ever said Republican. He's come pretty close to it. He's what you would call a moderate center right. That's how he describes himself. And he has a New York Times column for reasons. And he writing his most recent column on Democrats up on the stage during the debates, the first debates there, and some of the policies discussed, some of the things that they were. And so, again, the same thing's happening here. When Republicans talk about overturning Roe v. Wade or building a giant border wall, both of which while actually wildly unpopular, they're just throwing red meat to the base. They're just stirring up the rank and file. And that's just smart for political candidates and parties to do. When Democrats do it, which there was a lot of them doing it on the debate stages during those first debates, they're talked about from that other perspective. They're endorsing these wildly unpopular ideas. They're so far left, they're going to scare voters. And that's basically what Bret Stephens was writing about this week. But here's how he chose to write about it. So his overall point seems to be, you know, that I speak for and represent, as Bret Stephens, climate-denying moron, in cahoots with Barry Weiss in the oh, poor me crowd and running away from the Twitter mobs. And this is a crowd of people that first got their asses handed to him for trying to elevate and idolize Jordan Peterson in the, quote, intellectual dark web. And then once everybody realized that those were the people they were elevating, everyone called them on it and said, no, these are actual morons. And then Barry Weiss and Bret Stephens and the like were all victims. They were like, oh, the Twitter mobs came for us. Well, no, they were actually just pointing out that you're stupid. And that level of accountability was a surprise to you. And now you're a victim. No. Bret Stephens having the same response to the response to this week's column. What actually drew everyone's attention? Well, he's speaking again as if he is the unelected spokesperson for middle America, for the regular people. I think at one point in the column, he actually says normal Americans. So instantly there as a columnist, he's saying the Democrats on the stage during those first debates, none of them normal Americans, only he and his center-right crowd are normal Americans. Well, first off, that is just not true or backed up by any polling, census data, common sense, any of that. But still, it's what Stephens thinks, and the New York Times thinks it's worth paying for. He writes in his column, they speak Spanish, we don't. You remember there was a Spanish-speaking moment. They speak Spanish, we don't. They are not U.S. citizens or legal residents. We are. They broke the rules to get in this country. We didn't. They pay few or no taxes. We already pay most. They willingly got themselves into debt. We're now asked to write it off, talking about student loans. They pay the premiums for private insurance. We're supposed to now give up ours in exchange for some VA-type nightmare. They didn't start enterprises that create employment and drive innovation. We're expected to join the candidates in demonizing the job creators, breaking up their businesses, and taxing them to the hilt. So again, he's writing this as if, And he, I think, firmly believes this, that this is what's going through the minds of, quote, normal Americans. Again, no polling to back this up at all. And also a pretty frequent claim made by centrists in general, center left or center right. It doesn't matter if they're a centrist. They're always speaking for what they believe is the majority of Americans, even though centrist policy is actually wildly unpopular in the polls. And even though centrist policy is usually a gigantic clusterfuck when we've actually tried it, they are speaking for normal. These are the same people that say something stupid publicly, get laughed at by everyone, and then respond to it by saying, well, I made everyone mad. I must be doing something right. No, maybe you're just stupid. Bret Stephens is. He gets his butt handed to him for this column. He literally just everyone piling on, not a friend in place except Barry Weiss to back him up and defend him. And so he decides to take to Twitter to explain what he meant, because people are pointing out there are some there's a bit of racism in what he said. He's pointing out that there are some huge generalizations. They're pointing out that a lot of public opinion polling seems to contradict him. These are all very reasonable criticisms of a New York Times columnist or some guy at work that won't shut up. Reasonable, because these are people who are pointing to actual things, not just shit rattling around in Brett Stevens' brain, and saying, but Brett, and Brett's responding to this by saying, listen, I'm the centrist columnist here. As if that somehow should matter. So he takes to Twitter to try and explain himself after shitting his pants in this column. And he says, I write a column that attempts to represent the way ordinary voters likely saw the Dem debates. This representation of a view is read as an endorsement. It wasn't. Next come the accusations of racism. And one did come. Soledad O'Brien, one of the best Twitter follow decisions you could make, by the way. She took him on for it, and she took him on well. She got responded to by Steven saying that, you know, she was being mean to him, basically. He said that there are people I've never met accusing me of being something I'm not, a racist, whatever, Brett writes, but then unwittingly demonstrate a style of moral bullying and progressive demagoguery that turns people off and plays right into Trump's hands. So now suddenly he was writing the racist words just to try and make an example so that Democrats would realize, according to Brett Stevens, center right New York Times columnist, that they were going to get Trump reelected by not being center right where Brett Stevens lives. He says in a tweet, it's a tragedy. In case you missed it, my last 1,000 columns or so, I want nothing more than for Trump to lose. But right now, I'd bet he's going to win because the left is driving away the voters Democrats need to win. And then, strangely, he feels like he has to throw in the Twitter lengthy tweet equivalent of I have a black friend. He says, for what it's worth, my late father was from Mexico. My mother was a refugee. I grew up in the DF. I speak Spanish. I am a consistent advocate of liberal immigration policy. And I hear Soledad O'Brien is a decent person. I assume she will apologize to me. She didn't. Kudos to her for not. But look at the pattern here again. So Brett Stevens, who firmly believes he has the pulse on the majority of Americans, is basically saying this is what normal Americans were thinking. And then he writes a bunch of racist shit. And he's called out on it. And then he says, I was just trying to make an example. And now everyone else is being mean for piling on. Soledad O'Brien points out, no, what you were doing, doofus, is actually being really irresponsible and trying to brush it all off by saying, look, my best friend is black. This is a repeated pattern. There will be no consequences for Brett Stevens. The New York Times actually probably likes this, the controversy he creates, even though they're being extremely irresponsible by giving him a platform. And the guy lives in a fantasy of conservative white men who think they are more centrist than they really are and honestly believe that they have the exclusive thumb on the pulse of middle America, Main Street America. Honestly, these are people who can be credibly accused of sexual assault and come out on the other side of it, either still in a position of power or even worse, the real victim. These are people that can say widely, as Stevens had, widely inaccurate things about science, climate change, and there are no consequences. Anytime they are caught being full of shit, as Stevens is almost a weekly basis, it's just the Twitter mobs being mean that is the real problem. And then somebody inevitably will say, remember back in the day when things were more civil, you know, when the actual segregationists and the people that were just okay with it, if not advocating for it themselves, could get along and everything was fine. There's no recognition whatsoever. There's no visible or documentable awareness on this front from people like Brett Stevens. But now, here, to make this worse, to make this even worse, back to what we started talking about here and how the media chooses through editorial decisions, hiring decisions, headline phrasing decisions, the way polls are covered, the fact, again, that Republicans, when they go out in right field, they're just throwing red meat to the base. It's what parties do. When Democrats go out into left field, they are always, quote, endorsing a wildly unpopular stance. It's this overall landscape in which people like Bret Stephens thrive. And even worse, it's this overall landscape that keeps us from actually solving problems. Now, I'm not saying Bret Stephens himself is responsible for the fact that we haven't really done anything substantial about our immigration system in this country before we got to this year. I'm not saying Bret Stephens single-handedly stopped us from having something a little more robust and effective for keeping people alive and not bankrupting them all in the process than even Obamacare. I'm not saying Bret Stephens personally went out and stopped us from doing something about student loan debt, the cost of college in general, improving public education for everyone. I'm not saying he has been a busy guy thwarting all progress. But what I am saying is that the fact that Bret Stephens got hired and still has a job after the performance he's shown since being hired has a lot to do with why we haven't done any of those things. And even more galling, every single one of this very large group of people, almost always proudly self-proclaimed center right or center left, has absolutely no clue that they're actually the problem. They're just here to make the people who want that mindset reinforced. And there's not a lot of daylight between that mindset and the people that think things are, quote, changing too fast around them, which is just a fancy way of saying white people are kind of upset that it looks like in the future they might not call all the shots. This is all part of the same mechanism and the same system. Every tiny little cog and gear in this mechanism has a different result, and that makes it hard to think about broadly, because the result of a moron like Bret Stephens is a column is published, everybody laughs at him and mocks him for being stupid, he says everybody's being mean to him, he goes away for a few days, and then he writes another one. And it's easy to watch that process and think, eh, you know, it's, I just won't read his columns, but millions of people are. It's easy to say something like, well, yeah, sure. So the headline on a poll that shows the wall or overturning Roe v. Wade isn't popular, and the headline will read Republicans throw red meat to base and Democrats endorse something like Medicare for All, which is far more popular, although still not by a majority, far more popular than overturning Roe v. Wade or building a border wall is. And the headline will instead read Democrats backing wildly unpopular ideas. Yeah, it's an obvious bias, but it's easy to see that and think, oh, that was a bad headline. I'll just move on. But all this is all connected. It's all working as part of a major system that ends up producing, unintentionally sometimes, intentionally other times, a narrative. And the narrative can define everything from policy discussions to the outcome of elections on the state and national scale. So it really does matter. And I've always thought, to answer my own question I threw out earlier, what do you do about all this? Yeah, I mean, you're not going to convince a Republican they aren't the victim of the liberal media. Don't even try. You're not even going to convince a Republican to ask themselves if that narrative is true. They can't rethink it at this point. It's become dogma and is tied to the very core of the Republican Party's existence. They can't give it up at this point. You won't be changing their mind. You're not going to convince an editor at the New York Times that hiring and retaining the word salad producer that is Bret Stephens is a bad idea and might actually be hurting America, because that person's probably more looking at traffic and clicks, and a controversy isn't a bad thing in that situation. And who cares if the guy is that dumb, I guess. what can you do? I honestly think just being aware of this in your own reading. And I think sometimes you get opportunities. I know I have. I've gotten opportunities to subtly and not in an obnoxious, uninvited way. Well, occasionally, but usually not in an obnoxious and uninvited way, say to somebody, that's not true. Never if they're an elected official. Never. If I see an elected official or hear an elected official saying something along these lines, I just be blunt. In fact, be rude. They're elected officials. They're on a they have a higher standard they should be holding themselves to. So see an elected official share a, you know, PatriotNews1.net story. Call them the hell out on that loudly. But your coworkers, your family members, you know, you can be subtle. You can be nice about this. It isn't just about, I guess this is the point I'm trying to get to here. It isn't just about fake news. In fact, I kind of think fake news is a lesser problem because fake news fools stupid people and you can't fix stupid people. You can identify them and build a figurative fence around them. It's happened. Breitbart, when's the last time you heard them in any conversation that wasn't making fun of them? That's what happens. You know, eventually you're found out, and eventually even sharing a link from Breitbart becomes, as it did, a toxic thing to do, and the news organization just dissolves, or in the case of Breitbart, they go back underground to their hooded rallies. That's a natural process. The same thing will happen with fake news. The same thing will happen with public awareness, I think, when it comes to Russian meddling and fake news and social media in general. There's probably no saving the baby boomers. They'll seem to fall for anything. But up-and-coming generations, I think that's something that's not going to work as well as it did in 2016 ever again. That isn't to say we shouldn't take steps. It's more to say that I don't think there is a single step or set of steps that will actually fix it. And it's probably going to be attrition, to put it nicely. And public shaming, to a large extent, is going to play a part of this. But how do you fix this with the media? How do you fix the hiring of Brett Stevens and the phrasing of a headline? I honestly don't think any individual, organization, large group of people, or even entire political party could fix it necessarily. I think that the fix to this is, and I'll be fair here, the people that help contribute to this aren't always conservatives and Republicans. More often than not, they are. But just a few days ago, I was reading a progressive caucus Facebook page in my home state, and there was a conversation there happening between two progressives, Bernie Sanders supporters, apparently, talking about how they didn't believe the polls, that the polls were rigged, and they were in 2016, and of course, Sanders was cheated. That's none of that is true, and it doesn't matter to those people. That's what they want to believe, and they're always the most likely to be out on Facebook putting it in a comment or in a tweet or I don't know if people do that on Instagram. I don't see them do it. But either way, that's not something you can eradicate or do away with. It's human nature to want to believe something so much that you'll just, you know, hang on to bullshit like it's a solid rock. And the Republican Party has made that an art form at this point. I don't think they exist without it in their current iteration, and they know that, and they know they're going to have to put the bullshit down eventually, and then they'll become something entirely different or nothing at all, one of the two. And they're just trying to delay that as much as they can. And this mechanism that exists in the way information is disseminated in this country is helping them. That's not even the most frustrating part. The mechanism is also muddying the waters on understanding what actually is or is not publicly popular or close to a majority support or just barely a majority in opposition. The mechanism that exists is not, here I think is actually the worst part. The mechanism that exists doesn't foster and breed healthy newsrooms, nor is it built around journalists. And they become even secondary to all of this. And it's not just about avoiding the right-wing noise machine and the accusations of bias. Again, there's also a corporate bias. There's a business model bias. to a large extent, laziness, I think, plays into this as well. Brett Stevens is not great, but it creates a little controversy now and then. What newspaper wouldn't want that happening, right? Well, I mean, there are various ways to create controversy. So, final thoughts on this. I don't think there is a lot that can be done, and I don't mean to be cryptic or pessimistic. I think this is actually something that will improve. I think that part of what we saw with fake news and Facebook in 2016 is all part of a learning curve kind of transition. Social media came along fast, and it was adopted across the board even more quickly than any other communication platform in a generation. And so it takes a while to work out the bugs and get up to speed. And some of that working out the bugs does include user literacy. And so as that literacy grows, it will improve. When it comes to the media, I think, you know, as cliche it sounds, vote with your dollar there. It still works. Not as much anymore, but some still. I think the most effective thing we can all do, and this applies to everyone from leadership of the Democratic Party to the candidates, and I think most importantly, registered Democrats and supporters of the left-wing policy out there that is not as wildly popular as the headlines say, I think it's on us. I think it's going to rely on us more than anyone else out there, the rank and file, if you will, of the parties or of the political philosophies and ideologies or the specific public policy prescriptions to a problem. I think it's on us to make sure that the attention goes where it's deserved and that it's talked about in a way that matches a reality. But I think we're always going to be up against this machine, at least for now, that is subconsciously putting its own thumb on the scale with something that seems innocent, but isn't. The language that's used in everything from a lead sentence to a headline to an entire column at times that does ironically create a bias trying to ensure that there is no bias. So watch for it. Point at it when you see it. And of course, make fun of Brett Stevens every chance you get. Join that Twitter mob. It's fun. I'm Jason Williams, and I'll see you next week.